This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lieutenant Aaron Ouattara, is the first American commissioned officer to publicly refuse to go to Iraq. His reason? He says he believes the war is illegal. His court-martial trial is scheduled to begin February 5th. If convicted for refusing to deploy, he faces up to 2 years in prison. He's also facing 4 charges of violating the Uniform Code of Military Justice for public statements he made opposing the war and criticizing the Bush administration. He could be sentenced to 4 years for those charges. Lieutenant Ouattara's court-martial trial will be held at Fort Lewis in Tacoma, Washington, where he's been on desk duty since refusing to deploy. Ouattara enlisted in 2003, and after completing officer's candidate school, was deployed to South Korea, where he served with distinction. Also joining us, by phone from Hawaii, where Ouattara grew up, is his civilian lawyer, Eric Seitz, who will enter into our conversation a little later. Lieutenant Ouattara, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you refuse to deploy to Iraq with your brigade?
Well, I think basically back in January of 2006, I sent an unofficial letter of resignation to my chain of command. Prior to that, I had started to do some research into the Iraq war based upon my responsibilities as a leader and an officer to prepare myself and also my soldiers for our pending deployment. And in that research, I began to look at the culture of Iraq, the history, the events on the ground, the conduct of the military, and how the civilians were reacting to that, the nature of the insurgency and its causes, and also how we had gotten into the war in the first place. And I think I became very shocked at what I found, and that not only was the war illegal and immoral in and of itself, but the conduct of the United States forces and the policy of the government were also very illegal and immoral. And I had to look at myself and ask myself the question of who I was in the military and what I was being asked to do. And I came to the conclusion that I could not, as an officer, as a soldier who has sworn an oath to protect the Constitution, the safety and the welfare of the American people, and uphold the treaties and laws that we were all beholden to, I could not condone or enable the leadership within our government who were enacting these illegal and immoral policies in Iraq.
You've used the words illegal and immoral. Can you briefly explain why you've used those words to describe the war?
Essentially, the war was started based upon false misrepresentations of the facts, of the justifications for going into Iraq. And to me, that is a basic violation of our separation of powers when you have one branch of government that is misleading the other branch of government in order to gain an authorization of force to invade another sovereign country. And not only that, but Article 6 of the Constitution specifically states that all international treaties that we enter into, that Congress ratifies, become the law of the land, second only to the Constitution. It is illegal under our Constitution and international law to invade and occupy another country that is not an imminent threat to us, or if this action is not authorized by the United Nations Security Council. The war is also illegal and immoral through its conduct, in that the United States military, through the rules of engagement and the policies, are violating international norms and laws daily. And that includes the illegal detention of Iraqi civilians and the mistreatment, abuse, and torture as a matter of policy, and also the mistreatment of civilians and the sieges of cities, the use of illegal weapons. All those things are violations of the Geneva Conventions, the Hague Convention, and many other humanitarian and international laws.
When you made your decision that you saw the war in Iraq as illegal and immoral, and you therefore did not want to deploy with your unit to Iraq, how did you go about refusing to deploy?
At first, I wrote a letter of resignation, a kind of informal letter, basically stating that I could not condone or enable something that I felt was contrary to my oath and my duty as a soldier. And I asked requestfully to resign my commission. And I was simply turned down at first. I was told that I would be kicked out of the unit and be transferred somewhere else. But then I was ordered to deploy on the unit's mission readiness exercise over to Fort Irwin, California. And then when I came back, I was transferred from a combat position on the line company to over into the battalion headquarters. I was offered the job of staying within the bases, I guess. I think they, at one point, they thought I was a conscientious objector, even though I had stated that I wasn't. And they were essentially offering me a safe position. And I said, no, that's not the point. I am against this war totally, not just because I'm a pacifist or a conscientious objector. And so I turned down that offer, but they moved me anyway. And then they told me, they revoked my leave. The rest of the unit went on leave. And they said, by the time we come back, if you have not changed your decision, we will start legal proceedings. And when they said that, that's when I felt that I needed to have legal representation. And I asked Mr. Seitz if he would represent me. I had submitted an official resignation in April. It was turned down by the Department of the Army. I submitted another resignation through a different channel in late May, and that also was turned down. And when I saw that there was no other alternative, I believed that I needed to take this issue into the public arena and let the people know why soldiers were dying in Iraq and what their responsibilities were as Americans. And even after I was charged, we also offered to take non-judicial punishment, or I offered to take non-judicial punishment, meaning loss of rank and loss of pay, and while not admitting any guilt to anything. And I had, even before that, I had offered to deploy to Afghanistan in lieu of Iraq, and I was denied that as well because they said, if we let you go to Afghanistan, that means we would be admitting that there is something wrong with Iraq, and we believe there is nothing wrong with it.
But let me ask you, if they let you deploy to Afghanistan instead of Iraq, isn't that basically saying that officers can choose which country they want to fight in or which war they want to fight in, that somehow you have a choice and soldiers aren't supposed to have that kind of choice?
Well, I think we have to remember that we, as a country, including all of its citizens and the military, operate under the rule of law, and there is such thing as an illegal war, as determined after World War II. And soldiers, you're right, they don't have the right to pick and choose, but they have the duty and the obligation to determine if what they're being told to do, including deploying to a war, is illegal or not. And of course, that is also our right under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, military law. And every soldier who disobeys an order based that it's unlawful does so at his own peril. But if you are court-martialed and or if you face punishment over it, you should be allowed under the rule of law, in a court of law, to bring witnesses and evidence on your behalf that could testify to that order being unlawful. In this case, the judge has already predetermined that he will not allow any evidence or witnesses to testify that the war is illegal or immoral. He has already predetermined that the order is lawful. And in a sense, by charging me with missing movement, they are skirting the issue of the legality of the order. And they have also, they are also determining that the order to get on a plane is legal. And it has nothing to do with why you're getting on that plane or what are you going to do once you disembark. And I think that that's a disservice because the order that I was given was to get on the transport to go to Iraq and conduct combat operations. And what I'm saying is the conduct of the combat operations in Iraq as a matter of policy and rules of engagement are violating the law and have been in the past.
My guest is Lieutenant Aaron Watata. He's being court-martialed for refusing to deploy to Iraq. He says the war is illegal. He's also facing charges related to public statements he made opposing the war and criticizing the Bush administration. Also joining us by phone is his civilian lawyer, Eric Seitz. Eric Seitz, thank you for joining us. I know one of the arguments you wanted to make in the court-martial is that Lieutenant Watata, you know, refused to deploy to Iraq because the war is illegal. Illegal because the U.S. did not have the backing of the U.N. Security Council. But in January, a military judge ruled that you couldn't use that defense because the war's legality is a political question and not a question that could be judged in a military court. So where does that leave you in terms of the defense?
Well, as Aaron just said, basically the judge has predetermined the merits of the case, at least with respect to the missing movement charge. In addition to the missing movement charge, which carries a 2-year maximum punishment and the equivalent of a dishonorable discharge from the Army, Aaron is also charged with 4 specifications, 4 additional charges of making statements that constitute conduct unbecoming of an officer. So although we will not be able to defend as to the legality of the war and the order, which he clearly violated, we certainly will be able to bring much of that evidence in with regard to the conduct unbecoming of an officer specifications, because that's very vague and ill-defined, and we believe that we're going to be allowed to raise many of those issues with regard to the specific statements that he's alleged to have made that are punishable.
Well, let me read the statements that Lieutenant Watada is being tried for. Statement 1, I could never conceive of our leader betraying the trust we had in him. As I read about the level of deception the Bush administration used to initiate and process this war, I was shocked. I became ashamed of wearing the uniform. How can we wear something with such a time-honored tradition, knowing we waged war based on a misrepresentation and lies? It was a betrayal of the trust of the American people, and these lies were a betrayal of the trust of the military and the soldiers. But I felt there was nothing to be done, and this administration was just continually violating the law to serve their purpose, and there was nothing to stop them. Realizing the president is taking us into a war that he misled us about has broken that bond of trust that we had. If the president can betray my trust, it's time for me to evaluate what he's willing to tell me to do. Statement 2, I was shocked and at the same time ashamed that Bush had planned to invade Iraq before the 9/11 attacks. How could I wear this honorable uniform now, knowing we invaded a country for a lie? And statement 3, it is my conclusion as an officer of the armed forces that the war in Iraq is not only morally wrong, but a horrible breach of American law. As the order to take part in an illegal act is ultimately unlawful as well, I must, as an officer of honor and integrity, refuse that order. The wholesale slaughter and mistreatment of Iraqis is not only a terrible and moral injustice, but it's a contradiction to the Army's own law of land warfare. My participation would make me party to war crimes. So Lieutenant Watada is accused of conduct unbecoming an officer for making those 3 statements. And let me ask you, this is Lieutenant Watada's lawyer, Eric Seitz, how do you plan on defending him on those charges of conduct unbecoming?
Well, first of all, in the motions hearing that we had in January, we argued that the statements are perfectly permissible. There is certainly no doubt that even people on active duty in the military have the protection of the First Amendment, and we argued that those statements are nothing more than statements of a political nature which you hear on military bases or in barracks, and you've been hearing increasingly from military leaders, including several generals and other people who've been critical of policy in Iraq, so that he's being singled out for saying the same things which everybody is saying and which he's entitled to say. Now, the judge denied our motion to dismiss based upon that, and so now we're faced with the question of whether or not those charges and that language constitute conduct unbecoming of an officer, which typically involves adultery, writing bad checks, the kind of conduct which is clearly inconsistent with the moral obligations of somebody who's put into a position of responsibility. Our argument simply is going to be that in making those statements, Lieutenant Watada was in fact exercising all of the moral authority which he has to exercise as an officer in the military, and that it is entirely conduct becoming of an officer, and that more officers ought to be making those kinds of statements. So we are going to go right up against those charges basically and say that the statements that he made are not only true and responsible and thoughtful and sincere, but that they constitute carrying out the obligations which he was sworn to do.
No, Lieutenant Watada, you made those statements to the press, and I believe at a demonstration. Is that right?
I made these comments to 2 reporters, and also at a press conference, in which that was when I first announced to the public the reasons why I was refusing deployment to Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Now, the judge in the pretrial hearing said that there are limits to the free speech rights of military personnel, and that a military panel should decide whether these criticisms of the war could have endangered the morale, loyalty, and discipline of troops. Eric Seitz, as a lawyer, what is your understanding of the limits to free speech for military personnel?
Let me answer that in two different ways. First of all, there is a misconception that when you put on a uniform and take an oath that you give up your rights, that you're sworn to protect for everybody else. And that's absolutely untrue. The limitations historically that have been applied by the courts, both military and civilian, to people in military service are that they cannot participate in activities in uniform which are not approved by their command. They cannot say contemptuous or disloyal things about the president or the secretary of defense or other leaders that would undermine discipline and authority specifically within their ranks, that they cannot represent themselves as spokespeople for the military when they're making statements of personal opinion in which they may be criticizing or opposing official views. And obviously, they cannot do the same kinds of things that you and I can't do. They cannot incite riots. They cannot incite violence. They cannot do those kinds of things which cross the line from speech to conduct and are impermissible for all of us as well. But short of that, they can criticize, they can make statements both publicly and privately, as long as they do it within those parameters. And so there's no question that Lieutenant Ouattara has a right to speak out on controversial issues. The question really is time, place, and manner, and in this situation, he certainly was very respectful in the way he expressed his views. The problem we have with the judge's ruling is that he's going to leave it up to a panel of officers as to whether or not this speech is permissible. And when this decision is reviewed by higher military courts and up to and including perhaps the Supreme Court of the United States, they are going to be appalled that the limits of free speech are going to be decided by military line officers, because that's not something that I think ought to be done.
But they're deciding the limits of free speech for the military, not for civilians.
They are, but it's really a question that the military judge should decide as a matter of law, because speech is something that's obviously very highly respected in our system of justice, and it's being left up to a number of people who have no training and obviously have biases and experiences from the offices that they hold. But there isn't going to be a single person on that panel who hasn't either been to Iraq or doesn't know people who've been to Iraq and are there now. And all of them probably also know people who have been killed or severely injured or wounded in Iraq. And so the presumption is that we're dealing with a body of people who are going to make a decision as to free speech, who come to this decision with very severe biases. And that's why we're very concerned that this is not really so much a justice proceeding but a disciplinary proceeding.
And what's the distinction between a justice and a disciplinary proceeding?
Well, if this were a court and a trial, we would be able to air the issues in a fairly defined manner. And we've been precluded from raising defenses. We've been told that all of our witnesses have been denied, that if we're not going to be allowed to call any of our witnesses. And so, basically, the only real determination here is going to be not whether Lieutenant Ouattara is guilty or innocent of the charges against him, but what's the punishment going to be? And that's more in the nature of a disciplinary proceeding, which is, in fact, what military courts are set up to do.
So how much leeway do you have now in arguing Lieutenant Ouattara's defense?
Well, as I said earlier, we're going to have some leeway with respect to arguing to these court members that he should not be punished for making statements which he's entitled to make. But I'm not overly confident that they're going to be sophisticated enough to make the distinctions that the law requires of them under those circumstances. And we're also going to be able to argue in any punishment phase of the case that he was very sincere, he was very thoughtful, he was very respectful, and that the kind of statements and the thought process that he's gone through is something that ought to be respected and not heavily punished. But that really is the extent to which we're going to be allowed to make those arguments.
What are the larger principles that you feel are on trial in this case?
First of all, I think that at the time that Aaron spoke out and that this began to unfold in June of this year, the war was going on and the anti-war movement in this country was minimal at best. And I think that there was a lot of frustration on the part of people who realized what's been happening in Iraq and how horrendous it is, that there wasn't more outspokenness in opposition and more people putting themselves in positions where they were actually having an impact on whether or not this war could continue. I think it was pivotal for Aaron to speak out when he did, and I think to a certain degree we've seen a very significant change in public opinion in this country, in part because of the actions that he and a handful of other people have taken with enormous courage. And that that really was reflected in the election results this last time around, and in a climate where now as many as 70 or 80% of the people in this country are calling for an end to this war and are criticizing the basis upon which it was initiated.
Lieutenant Watada, you're at Fort Lewis, and that's in Tacoma. Do I have that right?
Yes.
And the Seattle Times, which is in the same area, the Seattle Times had an editorial about your case, and I want to read an excerpt of it. The editorial says, he, Lieutenant Watada, says he opposes the war. Not all wars, but this one. So do we. But we cannot support his request to be excused from opposing to Iraq. Soldiers have to go where they are ordered. That is the rule here and everywhere, and for reasons of military necessity. Watada was a volunteer and knew that when he signed up. He knew about the Iraq War as well. He signed up in 2003, the year of the U.S. invasion. He also should have known that once one joins the military, one loses the freedom to speak in ways that could damage soldiers' morale, a restriction that includes political criticism of the military's mission. And what this editorial recommends is convicting you on all charges and then giving you a dishonorable discharge. What's your reaction to what they say there, that you should have known that you had to obey orders and that the Army can't afford to let you get away with this, basically?
Well, the fact is that there is a higher law. When we join the military, we don't swear an oath to a person, or especially officers. In our oath, we do not swear an oath of loyalty to any one person or any group of people or even an institution. We swear an oath to protect the Constitution and also the American people as a whole. And we have to follow the rule of law as it says in the Constitution. And when I joined the military back in March 2003, I believed the administration when they said there was weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, there were ties with Saddam to Al-Qaeda and 9/11. We all know those things were false now. And there has been many reports coming out from former or retired CIA analysts and officers saying that the intelligence was not bad. It was intentionally falsified to fit the policy. And when we have, as I said, a group of people within our own government who mislead the public, who mislead the other branch of government in order to justify their war, that is a violation of the Constitution. And I have to say that regardless of what they convict me on, if they convict me or sentence me to, I am doing what I swore an oath to do when I joined the military 3 years ago. And as I said, I did not realize the extent of the deception that was waged upon us 3 years ago that I do now.
I know that some people listening to you are thinking that lieutenant is really just a coward. You know, he's hiding behind all this intellectual stuff, but really he just didn't want to risk his life in Iraq. I know some people are thinking that, so would you answer them?
Well, I think the more cowardly thing for me to do was to betray my own conscience and do something that I knew was totally wrong and order others to do that as well. And, you know, I'm facing some pretty serious consequences here. The fact that I will be going to prison for up to 6 years, I face a dishonorable discharge and all the ramifications that come from that. And I did not make this decision lightly.
So are you prepared to go to prison? I mean, are you trying to mentally prepare yourself in case that is the outcome?
You know, when we join the military, we say we will sacrifice whatever it takes to protect our country, the safety and the welfare of the American people, and our time-honored laws and traditions. And in some wars and in some instances, even in the present, many men and women are sacrificing their lives and their bodies in order to uphold this belief. And I believe that I am doing the same thing. I'm sacrificing my freedom in order to uphold the same belief in our laws and our traditions and the safety and the welfare of the American people.
Now, there is a Japanese-American veterans group that is opposing you, and they're saying that you're bringing shame to the Japanese-American community by not following orders. What's your reaction to that criticism?
I think what's important to understand is there are individuals within these veterans groups who are opposed to what I'm doing, just as there are individuals within these groups who are very supportive. When I was in Hawaii, there was a gentleman who served in the 442nd Infantry Regiment in World War II, and he used to be the head of the organization. He is not anymore. And he told the head of the organization now, who had said publicly he was opposed to what I was doing, that he does not speak for all Japanese-American veterans.
You know, that's an interesting question, because the debate over Lieutenant Watata's position has really raged in the Japanese community, but it really has rekindled a debate that began during World War II, when the Japanese were incarcerated as a race, and there was a debate as to whether or not they should defend the country that had put them in concentration camps. And that same debate has really raged in many respects now as a result of Aaron's actions. And frankly, from our standpoint, that's a good debate. And it certainly has been joined equally, as far as we can tell, on both sides. There are people who think that he should serve, and there are people that think that he shouldn't serve. But all of those people have had to examine the basis for this war and what it is that Aaron has been saying about why he isn't going to serve. And that's a good thing, because it has brought into the fray and into the discussion thousands and thousands of people who, up until the time that Aaron refused to go, have pretty much been silent.
Eric Seitz, let me ask you what the format will be of the court-martial trial on February 5th.
Well, we'll start out initially, as you do in any civilian trial, with a selection of the court members who are the military jury. And we will have the opportunity to question them individually to determine what their beliefs are and what their experiences are that they bring to bear in this case. Once a court is seated or impaneled, the government will then present its evidence, which in this case will take probably less than an hour or two, given the judge's rulings. And after that, we will have an opportunity to put on witnesses in defense, although they've denied all of our witnesses. So the extent to which we're going to be allowed to do that remains unclear. In all likelihood, Aaron will testify during that phase of the trial. And then after the court members make a determination as to the guilt or innocence on all of the pending charges, we will then have a punishment phase in front of the same court members, who will decide the ultimate punishment, to include the likelihood of a discharge from the Army and some period of incarceration.
What's the outcome you're hoping for?
Well, you know, with all due deference to the Seattle Times, if the Army were simply willing to discharge Aaron, we would take that. We've offered that a number of times. But they want to imprison him and make an example out of him. And that has not only to do with the fact that he dared to refuse an order to go to Iraq, but that he did it publicly and spoke out and has given the reasons for that. The Army is taking the position that they want him to serve a minimum of 18 months or longer. And I think when we get to trial, it's very likely that they're going to ask for 2 to 3 years at a minimum. Our hope is to minimize the consequences of this, because fundamentally, no one in the military, no one who's dealt personally with Aaron, believes that he's doing this to place himself out of danger. Everyone who's dealt with him, including his commanders, who respect his sincerity, feels that he's doing this as an act of conscience. So he's not a coward. He offered to go to Afghanistan. That really doesn't come into play here. He really is somebody who is conscientiously taking a position, and he should really be respected for that. If he's discharged, fine. If they feel he has to serve a short period of time, certainly less than what Lieutenant Calley served for being responsible for the massacre of people in Vietnam, we could live with that. But we can't live with a lengthy period of incarceration. We don't think that's called for in this situation.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot. Terry.
Lieutenant Aaron Watata's court-martial is scheduled for February 5th. His lawyer, Eric Seitz, joined us by phone from Honolulu. We invited representatives of the Army to participate in our program, but the Army's Media Relations Office sent us this statement. Because First Lieutenant Watata's court-martial will begin early next month, it would be inappropriate to comment on his specific case. The Army has complete confidence in the military justice system and believes Lieutenant Watata will be given a fair trial.